Hello, this is Gino Rothstein, and this is a response of the day for the 25th of Adar. This is actually a response that I heard about many years ago and then finally came across in my searches by date, and it was irresistible to me to talk about it because it's such a fascinating case. The case is from Binyan Sion, Rav Yaakov Ettinger, from Simon Kuf Nun Dalet, number 154. It's written on the 25th of Adar of Tafresh Yud Tet of 1859. And it's addressed to a Rav from Hungary, and this is the question. You have a man who leaves home on business. He actually leaves on with a friend on business, but he has a regular practice going away on business. He lives in like a small town, and he and a friend go off on business for a while at a time, and then they come back, and they leave their wives home. And it seems like they have some money, as we'll see from the case. So while the man's away, one time, a man comes, and he says he's poor, and his clothing, he says from Poland, and his clothing is torn, he doesn't have any place to stay, and he asks if he can stay there. So she agrees, and she, out of the goodness of her heart, now, it's not an empty household, she has children, she has staff, like helpers, and she allows him to stay, and she gives him a room, and he stays. Now, when he starts acting in this weird sort of interesting ways, he doesn't eat anything, meaning he's like a vegan, basically. He drinks only water, and he afflicts himself in ways that were thought of as being ascetic ways that were thought of as being indicators of righteousness. And he did this all day, and all day he sat in his room, closed off in his room with a sefer in his hand, and even at night he would stay up till midnight. There was a practice to say Tikkun Leil Chatzot, to mourn the Beis Hamikdash at midnight. He would stay up till midnight, and then he would be mitonen al korban beit elokeinu. He would bemoan and wail the destruction of our Beit HaMikdash, and then when he would go to sleep, he wouldn't sleep on the bed, he wouldn't sleep on a bench, he would sleep on the floor, and he would put stones under his head, and every day he would twice wash in cold river water. Right, in Europe in those times in the winter, the river water is very cold. We go, we wash in the cold river water, and this is what he did from the Sunday of Parshat Truma till the Shabbos of Parshat Tetzaveh. So basically 2 weeks, just about 2 weeks, 13 days or 12 days. Okay, and then Friday night of Parshat Tetzaveh, there's a change that we'll get to in a second. But as we talk about this fellow, it's interesting to me to watch that he doesn't seem to have any plan, and she doesn't seem to have asked him about a plan. I mean, he comes for help, and he says he needs a place to stay. That's fine, but it's unclear in the tshuva as to how long she thought he would stay and what she thought he was doing, meaning, if he's spending all day in his room with a sefer, he doesn't need to be making plans to either make money or to travel further or to build anything else. So it's a story where she doesn't seem to pick up on odd signals about him. Now, it could be that's because there were many people like that in those times, so it wasn't so strange. I don't know, but to me, it's strange behavior because he has no plan. So then, and I want to say that we don't know his story in this at all. We're only going to know her version after the fact. Because that Friday night, what happens is, after the meal is over, the children go away and the staff go away, and they all go to sleep, basically, in their separate rooms, like a separate part of the house. And this man, who by now, in the tshuva, we're going to call him a Ramai, he is a deceiver. He's still sitting at the table with a woman, and he starts having a conversation with her, and she asks who he is and where he's from, and he says, you know, I am actually Eliyahu HaNavi. I am Elijah the prophet. I am a sent from heaven, right? I am a messenger of God, and I am looking to find people to gather for Kibbutz Galiot to bring them back to Eretz Yisrael. So it's an odd claim on its face. Forget that. I think we think that Eliyahu would look differently and would have more money and with this and with this, but it's also not claimed because he hasn't been spending any time trying to find anybody while he's with her. But he says, and I can't tell anybody other than Tsinuin. So Tsinuin means people of proper character and people who are properly humble and modest and live the right way. It means all sorts of good things about the way people live. So he says, and I can't tell to anybody but you, I can tell because you're so special. Right? You're a Tsinua. He doesn't mean the way you dress. He means you're a Tsinua, the way you live your life. You're humble, you're modest, you've got the proper sense of privacy. And she, throughout this story, seems like they call her a Sikhluta or an Ivelet. She's taken in. Right, the word in English would probably be a fool, but she's taken in by this story for reasons that are unclear in the story, but she's taken in, right? Well, I'm not there. And there are lots of times today when I watch people who I would think nobody would take it in by, and yet people get taken in by them all the time. And I say to myself, how is it that that person was successful when that person is so obviously whatever it is, right? And I'm not going to, you know, give specific examples, but, you know, Steve Jobs, no longer alive. He's a person who I have to confess, it bothers me. So my son tells me, one of my sons, my younger son, tells me, well, it's because he did these great things. He produced these great things for the world. It's not quite true. He was successful even aside from that, and he just seems to have had some kind of a charisma that people got drawn in by, and I don't understand it because he mistreated people terribly. So, not our issue. So how is it that she could possibly believe him? It's unclear. She believed him. Now, it's also unclear as to whether the tshuva just called him a ramai, a cheater, a tricker, engaging in trickery, because obviously he wasn't the ONV. Now, I agree that he obviously wasn't the ONV, but I wonder about whether he thought he was Eliyahu HaNavi. And that's one possibility. Could it be that he was really so insane he thought he was Eliyahu HaNavi? Second possibility, also I think worth considering, is that no, that in that moment on that Friday night, he in fact was so, for whatever reason, was so taken with her that he came up with a lie that he thought he'd be successful. And we'll get to what he does with that lie in a second. But what about all the other stuff that he does that demonstrated his holiness, right? His refusal to eat meat and his only drinking water and dipping twice in the river and twice a day in the river and his staying all day in a room studying a sefer. Were those all build-ups so that he could, as we're going to see, this Friday night and then Motzei Shabbat, this Shabbat night and Motzei Shabbat, have relations with her? And this was all a scam so he could have two incidents of sexual relations with this woman? It's hard for me to imagine, and I think it suggests, perhaps, a more complicated reality where he wanted very much to be a holy person. He wanted very much to be one of these people who's an ascetic and doesn't have money and has to go from place to place, and they suffer throughout their lives, and they think they're doing what Hashem wants of them, and then he was so tempted that he gave in. And that would be, that doesn't make it right, it doesn't excuse it, and it doesn't mean that he was a Leo Navi in any way whatsoever, but it to me, if that were what had happened, it would be that much more interesting because it would mean that it's less distant from the rest of us, right? If it's just a guy who's so crazy that either A, he thinks he's Eliyahu HaNavi, or B, he doesn't think he's Eliyahu HaNavi, but he sets up, his whole plan was to convince her to let him stay, and he thought he had found prey, and he's just a con man, and he found her as prey, and yet all that he wanted out of her was two encounters. I don't know, that seems a little odd to me to put that much effort into just those two encounters and then to run away. But maybe that's what happened. But if that's not what happened, if what happened was he's a person, an odd person who has a certain sense of what it means to be very religious, and he finds her willing to support him, and then over his time becomes enamored of her and eventually does this terrible thing, to me that seems more plausible, I think, and more realistic, and then becomes more of a lesson for us. In any case, that's not our topic in the tshuva at all. Right? She goes to sleep that Friday night, and her room is right next door to the dining room. So she's going to sleep in the dining room, and she leaves him there at the table. And he studies a sefer until midnight. And I don't know what's going on at this time, but after midnight, after he does tikkun chatzos, I don't know if he took tikkun chatzos, after midnight, after he finishes going to sleep, he goes, la'at al etzbarach, he tiptoes into her room, he wakes her up, and he says to her, you know, I've been all over the world, and I've never found a woman as righteous as you. Right? So that part may be true, but here's the next piece. He says, who's worthy of being the mother of the Mashiach? And the whole problem is that your husband isn't worthy. So I have been sent from heaven to impregnate you. So that's an odd thing too, since it's not true that Mashiach is, you know, impregnated. But anyway, this is the story he tells her. And I'll impregnate you. You'll have a ben. You'll have a son. And he'll be Mashiach. And here's the proof. Now, it's an odd proof also for her to fall for. The proof that I'm Elio is next Tuesday, after I'm gone, open up that drawer. I've left there lots of money for you, but it won't be there if you open it before Tuesday. She falls for that story. She has, and he tells her it's like 400 ducats, which is apparently a huge amount of money, but it's only if she doesn't open it till Tuesday. So he has relations with her Friday night, and then again, we'll say Shabbat, and then on Sunday, early, before the sun comes, before the break of dawn, he flees. He runs away, and nobody knows where he went. So she is still taken in. Like, when he leaves, she thinks it's still part of the whole story. So she is so excited, she writes her husband a letter, come back quickly, Hashem has given us great success, Hashem has given us a lot of money, and he gets back on Tuesday, they open the aron, they open the chest of drawers, or wherever it is he told her he had left it, there's nothing there. When she sees there's nothing there, she realizes what she's fallen for. And I just want to say, you know, the easy way is to look down at her as look what she fell for, but I'm not sure, right? How, and today maybe nobody would have fallen for it. And I think the fact that if today nobody would, I'm not saying it should, was good to fall for it. You shouldn't fall for it because being asked to violate the Torah in that way, because she's a married woman, that should have been enough of a danger signal not to do it. So she shouldn't have fallen for it. But the idea that we believe in the possibility of righteous people being out there, or even the possibility of Eliyahu HaNavi being out there, I'm not saying these examples of it and his thing would have been a realistic way of thinking of it, but the fact that she had that level of faith, I think there are many people today who do not have that level of faith, and I think that itself is a loss, although in this case, obviously, had she been a little more skeptical, she would have avoided a lot of problems. So this is the problem. She's horrified. She says to her husband right away, oh my gosh, this is what happened, and I promise you that I was doing it, L'shem Shammai, I was doing it because I thought Hashem wanted me to do that, and as proof, as evidence, if you know about the man, he was disgusting looking. He was ugly, right? There was no possible reason that I would have been interested in him other than I thought what I was doing was Hashem wanted me to do. So the husband's not satisfied. He's not satisfied because he's not sure what he's supposed to do about it. So he comes to his Rav and he tells him the whole story in Hungary. And this Rav doesn't know what to do. The Rav called the woman in. She told the exact same story. So as far as the Rav can tell, the story is the story. Meaning it's not like there's something else going on. Like she just had a consensual affair with a guy and now she's trying to hide it under this. It seems that this is the story. So he said, he's told them they have to live apart until they can figure out what the halacha is. And now he's sending a letter to Rav Yaakov Ettinger trying to find out what they can do about this. So that's the background. That's quite a memorable background. A woman who thinks she's having an affair with Eliyahu HaNavi, she's having a relationship with Eliyahu HaNavi, and that's why she did it. Can she stay with her husband? Because let's remember that any consensual affair, if it's caught, means that the woman can no longer with her husband and she can't marry the man that she had the affair with. That's what the halacha is. We've seen examples of that before and questions about that before. We saw Rav Moshe, I don't remember who it was, I think it was Rav Moshe who held that the husband's not allowed to believe her. Rav Yaakov Ettinger is not going to hold that way. But I think we saw Rav Moshe or Rav Yosef, but I think it was Rav Moshe Feinstein who said the husband's not allowed to believe her, and that was the way he passed, that's the way he got around this problem. But Rav Yaakov Ettinger is not going to feel that way about it. So he says, I'm looking through this story and through the situation. I think it's very difficult to find a way out that she should be allowed to her husband because she had an affair. Right? So now she says she didn't mean it. Right? She says she was a shogegah. She didn't realize it wasn't allowed. And she says she was intending to do it for a mitzvah purpose, for L'shem Shemayim. So Rav says that's irrelevant to whether she can stay living with her husband. Meaning, let's suppose for a second she was right. I don't mean right to have the sexual relations. She's right that she counts as a shogegah. Doesn't count like she did it on purpose. And then, you know, in her accounts with heaven, it will not count like she's an adulteress on purpose deliberately. It will count as she mistakenly had an affair. Even so, that's not enough to allow her to continue living with her husband according to the Maharik, which is quoted in the Rama in Evan Ezer, Kuf Ayin Chet 178, that if a woman thinks for whatever reason that it's allowed to have affairs. So for example, let's say, you know, a woman grew up in an environment where there were what was once called open marriages, where people think, like in the non-Jewish world, there are people who have this crazy idea that even if you're married, you can have affairs with other people and it doesn't have to affect the marriage. So she thought that. So she has an affair. Or let's say, you know, the husband says to her, this could happen, theoretically, the husband says to her, I'm going away for 6 months. I know it's a terrible, long amount of time. No, if the husband says to her, that's all the receiver, we'll get to it in a second. That might be different. But let's say she thinks to herself, you know, it's 6 months and he's away and this, I'll relieve my physical urges a couple of times. It won't be a big deal. She thinks it's okay. So the fact that she thinks it's okay, says the Marik, does not change the fact that she will be Asura Lebala. She will not be allowed to stay with her husband. She may count as a shogeget in halachic terms. She may count as an unwitting, but it won't change the rule that she has to separate from her husband forever because it's not right here, it's there in the tshuva, because the pasuk says, Uma'ala ma'al bi'isha, if she betrays her husband. So whenever she betrays her husband, that's the problem. So having an affair is always a betrayal of the husband, even if she thinks it's okay, it's nonetheless a turning to someone else other than her husband, and that's the standard by which we decide whether or not she can stay with her original husband. So that's one issue that doesn't help. The fact that she was a shogeget, the Marik has said, the fact that she didn't realize what she was doing was a violation of halacha doesn't change the fact that she knew that she was having a relationship with a man other than her husband, and that's a ma'al in her husband, it's a betrayal of the husband, and therefore the pasuk and the halacha apply to her. That's possibility number one for Akula. Another possibility is that here, there are no witnesses to their having had relations. So if that's true, it's only her word. Like I mentioned before, Moshe Feinstein said, based on Tosfos and other Rishonim, that you don't have to believe her. See here too. So the Yaakov Etlin just said we have a paragraph in Shulchan Aruch, and Ebenezer Kufted Vav, chapter 115, paragraph 6, that if there are no witnesses that she was Zinta, that she had an affair, then we don't say she's prohibited to her husband, because we worry, halachically, that maybe this is a way for her to get out of the marriage, right? So this is something that came up in the time of the Gemara already, and from then in halakhic literature, that we never sure what people's motives are. That's an important point. I hear people today talk like they know exactly what somebody else is thinking and why they're thinking it. I think halakha shows there are many, many cases where we feel incapable of knowing somebody else's motives. Here's an example of that. When a woman comes, says tearfully, I had an affair, I feel so embarrassed, I'm ashamed, we worry halakhically that she's trying to find a way to get out of her marriage, and she's acting, because people do that. This is not a men-woman thing. This is what we're worried about, especially since, like we worry about today, women cannot, in fact, coerce a divorce or, you know, have a divorce at will. So you can imagine that somebody wants to get out of the marriage, especially if she's met somebody else, and whether or not they've had the affair, but she's met somebody else and she wants to see what will happen with that man. So we worry about that. So that worry means we no longer believe her when she says she had an affair. And even if she says she had the affair unwittingly, she's told that she's shogeg, she thought it was allowed for some reason. This is just in general halacha. It's not about our case at all. In general halacha, she thought she was allowed for some reason. She didn't realize it wasn't her husband. Right, a guy came and I thought it was you. There's that case, that book, that novel, and the husband dies and another man comes back claiming to be the husband. Anyway, I forgot what it was. Whatever it is. You can email me the name of the novel if you want to, groth@gmail.com, and it was made into a movie, and I'm forgetting it. So in any case, let's say she says she's a shogeg. It doesn't help, right? It doesn't help us in terms of believing her or not believing her, right? So we said, if she claims to have an affair, we say, we don't believe you because maybe you really want, we don't say out loud necessarily, but maybe you really want to get out of the marriage. So you might think, well, but what if she says she didn't do it on purpose? And shouldn't that mean we should then believe her? And that would mean, therefore, that they have to separate. The halacha is, nope, we don't do that, because there's a Truma Hadeshen, Hadeshen Maharai, who wrote that, no, we can say that maybe when she's saying this, his idea was she said it first because she wanted to marry somebody else. Then she remembered, or somebody reminded her, that to be thought of as an adulterous woman is going to leave her and her whole family forever with sort of a stain on it. So she said, oh, even though I wanted to marry that other guy, it's not worth it to be considered an adulterer, you know, to wear that, basically that halachic scarlet letter forever. So she tried to change her story. And in trying to change her story, she said, oh, no, I was a shogeget. So that would still mean we don't believe her, because maybe the original claim was a lie to get out of the marriage. Then now, she's only adjusting the lie to avoid the stain of being a scarlet letter woman, but she might still want to get out of the marriage, so therefore we don't believe her. So all of that would suggest that we don't have to believe her, and that might be a reason to let this woman, who thought she was having relations with Eliyahu HaNavi to be impregnated with the Mashiach, maybe we can now let her stay by saying, no, we don't believe you that this happened. So the Rav Yaakov just says, it's not going to work over here. Why is it not going to work over here? Because in our situation, she didn't change her story, right? The Trumas Adeshin's version was she changed her story to say, no, I was a shogeget, I did it unwittingly. Here, she never changed her story, right? As soon as she admitted what had happened, she apologized for it. She said she was a shogeget, and therefore that he shouldn't, and he then begged him not to divorce her. So it's not, we have all the evidence in the world that she's not trying to get out of the marriage, and therefore you might think to say, no, we can't apply that usual rule of not believing her, because here all the reasons you might think not to believe her are clearly not there, because she very much wants to stay in the marriage. So you say, no, it's still not true. Maybe you could say, right, so now you got to keep track of which way it's going to go. Is believing her better for her or worse for her? The answer is believing her is worse for her, because that means that couple has to get divorced. So far we've said, but the halakha is you don't believe her because we worry that she's trying to get out of the marriage. So not believing her in our case would be good for her, because we pretty much assume she wants to stay in the marriage. So then we said, well, but maybe you could say that if she says she's a shogeget, you can believe her, which would be bad, actually. So he says, that in the Trumas Adeshin said you don't believe her because we think she's adjusting her story. But in our case, maybe we'd say you believe, you can believe her because she never adjusted her story, and it's just the story up off. So if you believe her, then she's going to not be able to stay with her husband, and we have no reason to think she's not a be'acher, and therefore we'll believe her. So the Rebecca Lynch just says, no, maybe. And this is actually an interesting claim, because this is the kind of woman I cannot imagine possibly having so much arma, so much cleverness and sneakiness to her, unless she really fooled everybody. But she, maybe, he says, she made up the whole story because she knows that if she said she did it on purpose, nobody would believe her. And she wants to get out of the marriage. Maybe this woman is, rather than the way we've painted her so far, is just like a very innocent woman who lives a pretty righteous life and got completely taken in by a charlatan. That's one possibility. But halakhically, we have to worry that maybe, and we have a tradition of worrying, that maybe it's the other way around. Maybe for some reason she said she wanted out of the marriage, and she hatched a plan. And the plan was, when this guy came along, that she would, once he left, tell everybody a story. And she knew that if she told the story that she did it on purpose, halakh is you don't believe her. And you'd have to assume that she has that level of knowledge. She knew that you wouldn't believe her. So since she knew you wouldn't believe her, she made up a story that you would believe. And that's what she's doing. So maybe she's done that way. And therefore, all of that still is part of the idea that we generally don't believe women in these situations. And if we don't believe her, then maybe we don't believe her, especially since the Shulchan Aruch, as the Rebbe Gavin points out, never differentiates the kinds of stories. It's just we don't believe her story, so maybe we don't believe her. So, and then he says, in this case, I even have somewhat even more evidence maybe not to believe her, because when, in the morning, when staff came to the lady of the house's, the mistress of the house's room, they found the guy still there, but he was there on the floor. So on the floor, if he'd really been having an affair with her, he should have left, run away, not been in the room, because then it makes it look like there's something going on. So if he was on the floor, it sounds like nothing happened to them. So, of course, there's the other possibility is that he had the affair with her, but he's so used to sleeping on the floor, because it's one of his markers of his great religiosity, that that's what he did. In the case, so in that situation, you don't say, so you might have thought, well, there's raglai v'davar, we have proof of it. So whenever the halacha is, if there's evidence, not proof, evidence, right? So we saw her flirting with people in a way that makes us think that maybe or physically flirting in a way that makes us think they may have an affair. In those situations, the misalach of, we don't believe her because we want to set up the marriage, doesn't apply. So it gets complicated as to whether we do believe her or we don't believe her. So that's actually Machlokas Aharon. He goes through the Machlokas, and I want to get to other pieces of his discussion. But it's Machlokas Aharon about whether we count that as Raglai and the Davar or not. If it was Raglai and the Davar, we would have then be able to believe that she had an affair and say she has to separate. And if it's not Raglai and the Davar, then we don't. So the question is whether it's Raglai and the Davar, especially since his presence on the floor would suggest that it's not Raglai and the Davar. It's not evidence that it happened. It's not circumstantial evidence that it occurred, which would then change our attitude towards believing her story or not. The problem with all that is, says Rav Yaakov Ettinger, the Binyan Sion, that would all work if all we had was her story, then we'd say we don't believe her. But in this case, the husband is crying about it because he's clearly believed her and he clearly is worried about what to do. So when he's believed her, then we have more of a problem because he's not allowed halachically in the Shulchan Aruch, he's not allowed to stay with her if he believes her because he thinks that he's his understanding of it. So the truth is, there is a Ramah elsewhere in Shulchan Aruch that says in Kuvayin Chet and Eben Ezer, that says in the time of Eirim Benu Gershom, when he's no longer allowed to divorce her against her will, so then the Ramah says we worry about men too, meaning if a woman comes to us and says I had an affair, the halacha, long-standing halacha is we don't believe her because we're she's trying to get out of the marriage. Once Chaim Rabbeinu Gershom said he couldn't divorce her against her will, then we worry that if she ever mentioned that she had an affair, which halakhically he's not allowed to believe, that he'll claim to believe it because he wants out of the marriage. So you might think that still we're allowed to say we don't believe her, and the fact that he believes her is irrelevant to us. It's a problem because there are others who hold that even that in our times, we do believe he is allowed to believe her, or if he believes her, he believes her, and he has a choice, and he has to get separated from her. So here, since he believes her, you'd think that they have to separate, right? That's what it seems like. But, says Rav Yaakov Ettinger, since you see the Truma Sedition worked so hard to be makel and to allow husbands and wives to stay together, then it's his obligation and responsibility to do his best as well, and that's what he's going to try to do. So he's going to come up with a very clever and interesting suggestion for how it is you could decide that this couple could be allowed to stay together, even if we're forced to believe her story. So now he comes to what I mentioned before. The Maharil had said that the issue is ma'ala ma'al bi'isha, that she's betraying the husband. And that's the problem. It's a question of whether she thinks it's prohibited or not. It's a question of whether it's a betrayal of the husband. So he says, you know that too, because the story of Esther and Mordecai. Let's remember the Gemara thinks that Esther was married to Mordecai and then was taken from Mordecai and forced to marry Ahasuerus. And the Gemara's presentation, and this is midrashic, so I'm not saying the Gemara thought it was literal, but it might have been. But the Gemara says that she used to sort of have relations with both because for whatever reason. And it wasn't considered an affair because it was against her will that she was having relations with Ahasuerus. So if it's against her will, that doesn't count as an affair. But then when Esther goes herself to, because Mordecai tells her to, basically, but when Esther goes herself, she says, Kasher avadati avadati, when I'm lost, I'm lost. The Gemara understands that to mean that until now, I've been able to come back to you and stay married to you because it was against my will, but now that I'm going to voluntarily go to Ahasuerus, then I'm no longer going to be able to be your wife. And that was sort of the standard for her. So the question is, so the Maharil said, clearly she's not violating the Torah in doing this because it's to save the Jewish people. So it's a mitzvah rabbi is what he says. It's a great mitzvah. So it clearly shows, he says, that it's not an issue of whether it's prohibited or permitted, or she thinks it's prohibited or permitted. It's a question of, is it a betrayal of the husband? And now her voluntary going to Ahasuerus is a betrayal of Mordecai, and therefore it will count as an affair, and she will not be able to go back to Mordecai, even though it was the right thing to do. That's the way that Maharil is understanding it. Evidence for that comes, there's a story in the Gemara that as Esther is going into Ahasuerus' court, as she's about to present herself to him, the Ruach HaKodesh leaves her, right? The divine presence, the divine spirit leaves her. And then she says, Hashem, are you punishing me for what I'm about to do when it's an onus, it's against my will, and I just have to do it to save the Jewish people? And the divine presence comes back, and that's how she knows that she's doing the right thing. So that's going to be part of our story. But nonetheless, it seems like she's still prohibited to have returned to Mordecai ever because it counts as an affair. So that means even if she doesn't know it's prohibited, but if she does a voluntary betrayal of her husband, then she's betrayed her husband and she can't go back to him. And the Beit Shmuel, commenting on Shulchan Aruch, said the same thing, that if a woman has an affair voluntarily, even if it's to save other people's lives, so to save people's lives, as Rav Yaakov Etlin is pointing out, we do lots of things. We violate Shabbos, we violate Yom Kippur, it would presumably, so there's a Gilead Raya question here, he doesn't take up. He assumes that clearly her having an affair would be allowed as well under that same rubric, which I think is an interesting thing that he assumes, but he does assume it, and thinks that nonetheless it would mean that the couple has to separate, even though they were saving lives. So Rav Yaakov Etlinger says, I don't understand the Maharik's claim here, where she wants to have the affair. I understand exactly what he's saying, that it's not a question of whether or not she knows that it's prohibited, it's just a question of she knows that she's cheating on her husband. As long as she's cheating on her husband, they can't go back together. But if she's doing it for a mitzvah, then how is that considered a betrayal of him? She's doing what the Torah told her, what Hashem wants to do. That's even more of a question when it comes to Mordecai and Esther, because Mordecai is the one who tells her to go do it. Right? He says to her, go to the king. So how could it be that the Maharik's logic applies to that situation? And also, he points out, the Maharsha and the Rif raise the question of why we assume that Esther was Beratzon here, because in that story about the divine presence leaving her, what she says to Hashem is, and you're going to treat an onus Keratzon, which means she's thinking of her entry into Ahasuerus, into his court, at this moment where she's giving herself to him, sort of voluntarily. She's giving herself to him at her initiative, but she calls it onus Keratzon, and the Gemara seems to take that for granted, and then the divine presence comes back to her. It seems like she's right. So it doesn't seem like it's voluntary, and it doesn't seem like a betrayal of Mordecai. So why is it that this example would be relevant? So therefore, says the Rav Yaakov Etlinger, that if this was clearly a case of saving the Jewish people, he thinks everybody would agree that it's onus, and a woman who has an affair, but onus, against her will, and there's nothing she can do about it, there's no issue of her going back to her husband, other than if she was married to a Kohen, that's a whole different discussion. And she could have gone back to live with Mordechai, and they could have been happy. They could have been happy together. The problem was, before she went in, they weren't sure if that was true. This is very clever, very interesting, and I'm sorry that it's taken me till 28 and 35 to get there, but it's a very interesting discussion, because he says, Mordechai says to her, if you don't go, Hashem will find another way, and you and your father's household will be destroyed. But then he says, he adds, "Umi yodea im la'et kazot higat la'malchut." Who knows? Maybe this is the whole reason you became the queen. Now, who knows doesn't mean, and I know that it's true. It means maybe. So if it's a maybe, then it means that it's not clear to either one of them that when she goes to Achashverosh, that it's actually necessary for the salvation of the Jewish people. So if it's not necessary for the salvation of the Jewish people, then it won't be an affair, then it will count as ma'ala ba'mal, as betrayal of Mordechai. Now, it'll still be allowed. Why will it still be allowed? Says Rav Yaakov Ellinger, it's still allowed because al safek nefashot gam kein mechalin afilu Shabbos. So first, notice again that he's left out the idea that maybe this should be considered a gilui arayot, sexual perversions, incestuous relations, and those kinds of things that are generally not, well, those are one of the big three that we're generally not allowed to transgress, even to save lives. Let's leave that aside for now. But also notice that he assumes that it's already considered a safek nefashot. If we know there's a threat to the Jewish to people, and Esther and Mordecai legitimately think there's a chance that by her doing this, it could save their lives, Yaakov Ettinger assumes that that's allowed. That's a very broad definition of what's considered saving lives. He just throws it in there. He just takes it for granted. So in any case, she's going to the court because maybe this is the way Hashem wants the Jewish people to be saved. That's allowed. But if it's not the way Hashem necessarily wanted the Jewish people to be saved, then her doing this will maybe not count as a mitzvah act such that she can then return to Mordechai. And that's why she says, Kasher avadati, avadati. When I go now, since it's a suffix, if it turns out that I'm wrong, then I won't be able to come back to you because it'll turn out I will voluntarily, not willingly, but voluntarily have had an affair, and therefore it'll count as a ma'al. And that's why he suggests when the Shekhinah left her as she was walking in, she got worried. And she said to Hashem, I'm not doing this because I want to. I'm doing this because I think that's what you're requiring of me. And then, when the divine presence returns, that confirms that she was correct. And that's why, that's the way Hashem wanted the Jewish people to be saved. And then, in fact, he says, the end of that story is that she was able to go back and live with Mordechai because it turns out that she didn't have a voluntary affair, which I think is his kiddush. He's suggesting that. I don't think there are any, I don't know of any traditional sources that say that that's true. So his basic point is that the definition of an affair is if she has reason to think that this is the mitzvah from Hashem to do it, and that Hashem wants her to do this, that's not called betraying her husband, because then it's the will of heaven. That's not a betrayal of the husband. So how would that apply here? That would apply to this woman, because she thought, wrongly, but she thought that Hashem had told her to have a relationship with this man, and therefore maybe you can say it doesn't count as an affair. So he says, I really don't want to argue with the Maharik and the Beit Shmuel, who held the other way, who just seemed to say that whenever she has relations with another man, it's a betrayal of the husband. But he says, I saw another example of it, the Shvut Yaakov, another case, which was Yaakov, let's say a man and his wife, and a bunch of people walk together in the forest, and then, you know, murderers come upon them, highwaymen come upon them, and they have no way to save their lives. But she comes either, so there's two possibilities. They say to them, if you give me your wife for us to, you know, violate, we'll let you go. That'd be one possibility. Shvut Yaakov says, if the husband says, go ahead and do it, then it doesn't count as a betrayal of him. So the Shvut Yaakov said, that's only true, though, if they name that as the price, because then there's an onus on the actual act of sexual relations. They are coercing them at threat of their lives, the threat of death, to let her have an affair. And by the way, let's remember, I just want to stress it, Yaakov Ellinger is clear that there's no issue of Yehoreg Valyavor here. She's allowed to do it. And not only is she allowed to do it, it doesn't count as a betrayal of her husband. But if the Shvut Yaakov said that if she comes up with the idea, or she and her husband come up with the idea, but if she comes up with the idea and offers them sexual favors to free them, so then she wasn't coerced on it. It's the right thing to do because it saves lives, but it will have been, in that sense, a voluntary betrayal of her husband, and she won't be able to return to her husband. That's what the Shvut Yaakov said. So in our situation, if you apply that logic to Shvut Yaakov, the guy who pretended to be Eliyahu HaNavi, he's the one who named the idea of sexuality as being the way for them to move forward. That being true, then there's reason to believe that she was only following his lead, and once she's only following his lead, then maybe it wasn't a betrayal of her husband, and maybe they can stay together. That's what he suggests, that's his idea, that's his way for them to get around it, that in this case, her act of sexual relations didn't constitute a betrayal, not because she thought it was allowed, that's not good enough, but because she thought that Hashem commanded her, and not only that, but she thought that the way to do this act. It wasn't she who suggested the sexual part of it. It was indicated to her. And in those situations, maybe you can stay. They stay together. He says you need to get two other rabbis who are Baalei Ra, who are of rank to rule on these kinds of issues. And if they agree, then I agree, and then they can stay together. And that is a tshuva day for the 25th of Adar, a remarkable tshuva I first heard about, I think, when I was 18 years old, and it's a remarkable case, a woman being fooled so much into believing that Eliyahu Navi was impregnant here to produce the Mashiach, and Rav Yaakov Ettinger's struggles to try to help them and let the couple stay together. Have a great day.